You're listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast. Approximately one in every five state prisoners is serving time for a drug offense, and in 2012, drug offenders made up about one-third of the federal criminal caseload. Each year, about 60% of all federal drug offenders are subject to a mandatory minimum sentence. Tonight's show is about drug sentencing, about mandatory minimums, and the effects of current incarceration on substance users, their families, and the community at large. Joining us in the studio is a leading legal expert in the field. Her name is Barbara Dugan. She's the Massachusetts Project Director for FAMM, F-A-M-M, which stands for Families Against Mandatory Minimums. Prior to joining FAMM, Barb was a staff attorney at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights in Boston, handling racial violence and police misconduct litigation. And in 2010, she was named one of the top women in law by Massachusetts Lawyers Weekly. Welcome to Right Turn Radio, Barb.
Thank you, John. A pleasure to be here.
Thanks for being here. Tell me about mandatory minimums. When did this start?
Massachusetts likes to be ahead of things. So we enacted our mandatory minimum sentences for drug offenses before the federal government did. People tend to know about this issue on the federal level, but Massachusetts, we were there first. We enacted our laws in about 1980-81, early 1980s.
A lot of people associate the Reagan administration with some of these laws. Is that true that on the federal level they came out that way?
They started at the federal level, I think, around the mid-1980s, maybe 1986. I forget who was president then, but that's when they really, there was an earlier version that was repealed, but then they came in again with a vengeance in the mid-1980s at the federal level.
So what do they do? What does mandatory minimum mean?
Okay. It means that when you stand before a judge, assuming you've been convicted of an offense, and I'm talking only about drug offenses, you expect that the judge is going to take into consideration a number of things when sentencing you, because the sentence should fit the crime. That's what justice is about. So you expect that the judge is going to look at what you actually did, how what sort of rehabilitation might be best for you, mm-hmm. If you have a prior record, if there's other factors that argue for or against a certain sentence. However, when you get before the judge, you're going to find out in Massachusetts that at least your minimum sentence was already set 30-some years ago. And if you've got a child who's dealing with these issues, your child's sentence was determined before he or she was born.
So let me get this straight. It doesn't matter if I meet certain criteria for what's considered a drug offense, mm-hmm. It's written in stone, if I'm found guilty, that I'm going to serve a minimum requirement sentence.
You're going to serve at least X number of years in prison. There's no other resolution. Everybody goes to prison. You may be an addict who instead needs treatment, or a drug court, or maybe you're somebody who would do better with probation, or even a short sentence. Can't do it. The courts must send you to prison, and often for a disproportionately long sentence compared to what people get for more violent crimes.
Why do these laws exist?
Well, that's a very good question. I think, you know, I can tell you what the rationale was when they were first proposed and enacted. Three things. The thought was that the threat of a serious penalty would reduce drug offenses, that the threat of a serious penalty would reduce drug abuse and addiction, mm-hmm. and that sentences would be more uniform and consistent among people who get sentenced.
Well, that sounds great.
It sounds good. And you can see that it's, you know, these are reasonable positions to have taken 30-some years ago, although I would add that there was absolutely no evidence that these policies would do that. It was a vast social experiment. But at least 30-some years ago, we didn't know what we know today. Here's what we know today.
Yeah.
They don't reduce drug abuse and drug addiction. I mean, clearly we're in the middle of, an, especially with opiates, an overdose crisis.
Right.
They simply don't do that because they only allow one alternative. You go to prison, which is, you may or may not get treatment, but so it hasn't affected substance abuse. In terms of the number of drug offenses, they have not gone down. I mean, I don't know what it was initially, but there's a state agency called the Massachusetts Sentencing Commission that keeps track of every single case that goes through the system. And for the last 20 years, the number of people who've been sentenced to mandatory minimums, it does fluctuate, but it holds steady in about the 700 to 900 year range. Hmm. And the fluctuations, it's unclear what leads to those. So you would expect to see this diminishing number of drug offenses to, you know, the magical nothing is happening. But in fact, it's holding steady. And I think it shows that for every low-level drug offender who gets sent to prison, there's somebody else who comes in to take his or her place.
So let me get this straight. 30-year-old laws based on kind of just what seemed politically expedient or what the feeling was at the time.
Sounded good.
Oh, there was the crack epidemic. You know,
not yet.
But it was starting to, it was starting to show its face. People were scared. There was still kind of the way of let's you know, there's a moral choice involved with addiction, so let's punish them and send them, you know, if you hold the kind of sword over their head saying, if you do this, you're going to go to jail for this time. But you're telling me that hasn't worked, that hasn't really affected the situation.
That's exactly right. I mean, when you think about who's serving these, there, some people have no issue with substance abuse. Others are addicts. I mean, you folks know better than I do that if you're addicted, if you have a chronic brain disease, the threat of a possible sentence somewhere down the road is meaningless.
We know that.
Most of the folks that are incarcerated members oftentimes had no... They didn't even know these laws existed.
Right.
So they clearly, that's not what they're thinking about. They're thinking about, where do I get my next fix? Not, I wonder what the statute is on this particular offense for 32 grams of cocaine.
Right. Well, I mean, so this is part of, you know, the outcome, the kind of the natural outcome of the war on drugs. I read somewhere where the prison, federal prison population, since these laws were enacted, has grown 800%. Is that correlated with these laws?
I don't know about the growth, because there's been sort of over-federalization of a lot of crimes that used to be dealt with at the state level. But currently, I mean, we're talking mainly about Massachusetts right now, but the federal stuff is even worse. They enacted their laws in the, I think, 1986, and then they've increased, they've add on more and more. And about half of all the drug offenders in prison right now, or about half of all the prisoners, are there for nonviolent drug offenses. That's thousands and thousands of federal prisoners for drug offenses.
Well, so these are kingpins that are in there for distributing huge amounts of drugs, correct?
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, that's who these laws were intended to nab. The judges in Massachusetts usually say that they never see a kingpin coming through their courtroom. And at the federal level, I mean, there may be some of those folks, but too often it's some low-level person who played a minimal role in the offense. I mean, it's, conspiracy theories are used for drug offenses. So if I actually sell you, you know, enough cocaine that would warrant what is now an 8-year sentence. It used to be 10. I could get that sentence if I'm the person who's running the operation. But if someone who played a much more minor role could also get it. The person who gave someone a ride, the person who made a phone call, the person who had drugs stored in their house, sometimes unbeknownst to them. So, no, the short, sad answer is it's not just the kingpins.
It just seems so kind of wildly unequal as far as the way sentences work. Barb, tell us about how FAM came into existence.
Sure. My boss, Julie Stewart, is our founder. And 20 some years ago, her brother was convicted of growing marijuana, spindly, pathetic marijuana plants, but that doesn't matter to the feds, and was sentenced to 5 years in federal prison. Julie was astounded, like so many family members are, to see her brother come before a judge and find out that the judge had no choice but to send him to prison. So Julie did what probably most brothers and sisters don't do. She decided that this was outrageous and started FAM, which originally, I think, was, you know, a card table and two folding chairs somewhere in Washington. And we are, our main office is in Washington, D.C., and most of the work there is about drug sentencing policies at the federal level. But I should add that FAM is more than just drug sentencing policies, although we sort of started out like that.
Okay.
And in Massachusetts, that's what we focus on. But we also look at the whole general scheme of mandatory minimums for other offenses, too. Mm-hmm.
So what do you work on sentencing laws at the state level in Massachusetts?
That's what I do, the Massachusetts work. Our work is to try to repeal mandatory minimums for drug offenses, or at least incremental reforms until we get to that point.
So give us an example of projects you've worked on in Massachusetts.
Well, we've had actually the last two sessions of the legislature, we've gotten through the very first reforms in Massachusetts.
Wow.
In 2010, I mean, one of the things we also do is we draft legislation and then legislators file it for us. So in 2010, we got through the first ever reforms to the drug sentencing laws in Massachusetts. Doesn't sound like a huge thing. What it meant is that drug offenders serving mandatory minimums at the county level and county houses of correction became, some of them became eligible for parole. However, the way I look at it is that it was like the first brick being removed from the wall. And it is an unsustainable system here.
Yeah.
So that weakened things. And it was, so it was huge in some sense that it was the first ever reforms here, but affecting a smaller number of people. In 2012, we got through far more significant reforms. Mandatory minimums for many of the more serious offenses were shortened somewhat. Drug offenders became eligible for parole either for the first time ever or at an earlier date than they were. And they also became eligible for what's called earned good time credits and work release programs. So these folks who had been excluded from the very programs that aid someone successfully get back into the community were now available to them as well.
Great. So you're doing some good work here.
We think so. We love it.
I want to talk about the kind of political support that, you know, the repeal is getting of mandatory minimums, or that, you know, that that different sides of the aisle are showing for that. But we have a caller. Dave is calling. Hi, Dave. Welcome to Right Turn Radio. Do you have a question?
How are you?
Good. How
are
you doing?
Well, it's obviously that this FAM, drug laws in Massachusetts are federally aren't working, because the problems get worse and worse and worse.
What do you think is gonna make a difference, Dave?
Well, I think the laws are much too liberal, and especially for the drug dealers. And I think they should be and they should go for the source of where the drugs are coming from, whatever country it is. This country gives away millions and millions and millions of dollars to these countries that we're getting the drugs are coming into this country.
Well, Dave makes a good point, Barb, about, you know, there's kind of an inequality of the stuff. What do you think about going, you know, putting that some of the energy that we use and some of the resources we use going towards interdicting some of the bigger names? Because it sounds like there's a very huge inequality in the way these sentences are happening.
Well, I don't know the international dimensions of this. I mean, it is true that this is, in some cases, it's a foreign policy issue. That's way beyond me. But I think Dave raises that interesting issue about people tend to pit addicts against dealers, with this idea that they're two separate groups. However, and sometimes that's true. And so we hear a lot of talk about now we hear at least people talking more intelligently about what addicts need as opposed to it being a moral failing,
right.
a disease that needs treatment. But there's still a lot of talk about there's the addicts that we need to protect, and then there's the dealers that we need to throw them in prison and lock away the key. The reality is that many addicts are selling. They're in the drug trade. That's what their life is about. It overwhelms their lives. And so they play low-level roles. They are willing to help out in small ways because that way they are in contact with a constant source of the drugs that they need. So when there's just no bright line between addict and dealer. There's some people who are dealers who aren't addicts or users, and there's some who are, but there is definitely a significant overlap. And those are the heartbreaking stories that we see, where somebody was involved because of their addiction and yet are treated the same as somebody who's a kingpin. And that's where your nonsensical inequality comes in.
It seems like in a lot of ways there's almost, you know, anybody who looks at this other than the prosecutors that benefit from these laws, many people who look at this see the inequality, see the injustice, and see that it's, like you said yourself, it's not fiscally feasible to keep this stuff going. We can't sustain this kind of prison sentencing and you know, it costs, what is it, $46,000 a year in Massachusetts?
State prison is an average of $46,000 a year, yes.
And for treatment, treatment starts around $10,000. You get, there's a cost benefit there. People, what surprised me when I was doing research for the show is that people that you would think would be leaning more towards the right and kind of law and order people are that come out in favor of this, people on both sides of the aisle. So there's Rand Paul, who's a Republican from Kentucky. This is his quote, "Our federal mandatory minimum sentences are simply heavy-handed and arbitrary. We should not have laws that ruin the lives of young men and women who have committed no violence." And then Pat Leahy from Vermont, Senator Pat Leahy, says, "In addition to driving up our prison population, mandatory minimum penalties can lead to terribly unjust results in individual cases." So here's two guys who are politically on the spectrum, very far apart, are saying basically the same thing. These things aren't fair. They're filling up our prisons, and they are. It's unsustainable. I'd like to understand better how this affects different people. I looked at a statistic on the federal level, and is disproportionately weighted towards minorities who are affected by this. Although there was plenty, it also feels like it's disproportionately weighted towards people who are financially less well off than other people.
Well, I think you're describing the criminal justice system in general. In particular, for drug offenses, at least looking at the data for the last 20-some years as provided by the Massachusetts Sentencing Commission, we tallied up all those numbers, and it's an average of 77% of drug offenders who get mandatory minimums who are people of color. Yet the adult population of people of color in Massachusetts is more or less 20%, depending which census you're using.
Why is that?
I think a lot of it has to do with where the law enforcement is easy to do. I mean, if you're in communities where you have more drug activity out in the open, that's an easy place to do enforcement, but it also reflects the values of who we should be punishing. I mean, let's use the R word, right? I mean, this has a lot to do with race. One of the examples I give, which please don't anyone think I'm suggesting this, but can you imagine if we totally, repealed the Fourth Amendment? I mean, we've certainly gutted it in many respects. And the police went into every college dormitory in Massachusetts and arrested every college kid here who sells or possesses drugs. I mean, the numbers, then I think there would be a clamor. This, all these laws, like the draft, right?
Yes.
This is terrible. We have to undo it. But it has a lot to do with who we value. Who do we think it's appropriate to just throw away and put them in prison?
Now, when you go to prison, there's certain things that you can't do. You can't vote. Is this correct? I mean, there's certain rights that until your record is clear that you're going to have a hard time. This follows you for a long time. So you could be describing some of your situations. You could be an addict who has 8-10 grams there's different levels of,
right.
But of heroin or cocaine with them that gets a distribution charge. The next charge is possession with intent or whatever they are.
Up to trafficking.
And this follows somebody that can follow them for their whole lives.
Exactly. I mean, I think that's what Michelle Alexander does a really good job of in her book, The New Jim Crow. I mean, she's not just talking about the war on drugs. But in fact, if someone goes to prison, let's say, for 8 to 10 years for a cocaine offense. When they get out, they're going to have a very hard time getting a job. It shouldn't be that way because they've, in theory, paid their debt to society. But they're going to have a record of a felony conviction for a long time. Fortunately, there's been some changes to what we call our CORI laws, which stands for Criminal Offender Records Information, which can be sealed after, I forget the details. I should know this, but 7 years, 10 years?
I think it's seven, but it's
hopefully
changed.
One of your callers will let us know.
Yes.
But, you know, we continue to punish people long after they've been out of jail. One of the laws we have on the books here, which many states have, is a law that requires the Registry of Motor Vehicles to automatically suspend the driver's license of anyone who's convicted of any drug crime for up to 5 years. So if you come out of prison and you can't drive, that makes it a tad bit hard to get. I mean, it's bad enough that you've got a record that your employer is going to know about, but you can't even get to the job interview if you don't have a car. I mean, it's a huge issue in terms of people needing it for a driver's license for employment, for getting their kids to where they need, or if you're someone who's in treatment, to get to your appointments. Fortunately, that may be changing. There is a provision in the Senate's version of the new budget bill that would repeal that law, which would be just terrific and such common sense. But it's one of the many collateral consequences. That's our big word for just the stuff that trails you long after you've done your time and paid your debt.
So why do these laws still exist? It sounds like just a massive failure. We've given them 30 years to work on our problem. They're not working. It seems like almost everybody politically agrees with this. I read a quote from Grover Norquist, who isn't exactly Mr. Feel-good, left-leaning guy.
He's
a tax reformer and very strong in you know, kind of the right-wing world, and he wrote, "It appears that mandatory minimums have become a sort of poor man's prohibition, a grossly simplistic and ineffectual government response to a problem that has been around longer than our government itself. Viewed through the skeptical eye I train on all other government programs," and he's not minimizing it there, "I have concluded that mandatory minimum sentencing policies are not worth the high cost to America's taxpayers." So fiscally, it's a failure. Socially, it's abhorrent. Why do they still exist, Barb?
Well, I think you may be a little over-optimistic about the current political situation. I mean, at the federal level, you do have some big names coming out with a very different view. A group that gets a lot of credit for the conservative getting into this issue is a group that's based in Texas called Right on Crime. And, you know, they've come at it from their own angle. This issue, I think, in the past has always been associated with, compassionate liberals or whatever, and also just the egregious racial disparities. But right on crime, I mean, their position is, look, if you're a true conservative, you don't believe in throwing money at a problem unless you've seen that this is a government program that actually works. And it's not working, giving our recidivism rates. We should hold corrections in the criminal justice system to the same standards we hold other government programs to, which is unless they're vital, unless they're working the way they're supposed to, something's got to change. So last month, the legislature had a public hearing on two of the bills that FAM drafted that were filed for us by Representative Swan from Springfield. And we brought in from Right on Crime a former Texas legislator named Jerry Madden, who came in from that angle, you know, in Democratic Massachusetts to say, look, you can do this. It's, you know, it's not about the politics. You've just got to put that aside, get down to the business at hand, which, as he accurately points out, is saving lives.
Yes. So you're fighting the good fight in Massachusetts.
We think so.
You've probably seen a lot of these cases come across your desk. I'd like to hear about some of them, you know, because it's kind of, you know, it's all just kind of discussion around the laws. I'm interested in knowing the human cost or the human toll of these laws. Can you give us a couple examples?
Absolutely. I mean, we can talk statistics and statutes all day long, but one of the things that FAM tries to do is to put a human face on our sentencing laws. In Massachusetts, I can tell you the stories of a woman who was a cocaine addict who started dating her dealer. I mean, this is not uncommon. And was in the next room when a major drug deal went down that involved over 200 grams of cocaine. That's about the size of a can of baking powder. Yeah. And she was offered a plea deal, which she turned down, 3 years. The prosecutor thought that she deserved 3 years for that. She declined because she didn't think she should be convicted at all, went to trial. Long story short, she was convicted and was sentenced to 15 years in prison for being in the next room when a drug deal went down.
This is in Massachusetts.
It is in Massachusetts.
And this is 40 years ago?
No, she came home in 2012, right after the 2012 reforms were enacted.
That's shocking to me.
Her children were without their mother for nearly 15 years. I mean, we were paying for her to be locked up for 15 years for being in the next room. And everybody else in the drug deal got out sooner than she did because they had information or assets to exchange for lower charges and a lower sentence.
This is obviously, I mean, a very big, big issue. It's a very complicated issue. I would imagine there's many legal facets to it that you have to deal with. But it's fascinating. When we come back, we're going to talk about what we can do about this issue and how we can, you know, our listeners and the public at large can affect and change these laws that sound grossly unfair. We were talking during the break about just how large of a problem this would be to reform, but you guys are in the trenches working on reforms. I like that. What can we do about this? How does this work? How do you get this? You know, if somebody if a public member is concerned, listen, I don't want these people running around. They should be punished if they're selling drugs. They should go to jail. What do you tell that person?
Well, I mean, I'm glad you asked that, because FAM is not pro or anti-drug. We're not pro or anti-decriminalization or legalization. I think what we suggest is a pretty modest proposal, which is that the sentence should fit the crime. So we simply say if drugs are illegal in Massachusetts, then when someone is convicted of a drug offense, the judge should be able to look at all the factors in their case and decide what's a fair sentence, especially one that takes into consideration whether or not the person is a threat to public safety and what they need, especially for addicts and substance abusers, what they need to get back on their feet to break that revolving door, that cycle of recidivism.
A lot of these people we're talking about are nonviolent drug offenders.
Exactly.
Correct? Okay. If somebody is in court now and there's, you know, mitigating factors, is there anything that can happen? Are there any, you know, if a judge sees, you know, something like the woman you were talking about who got 15 years for, you know, conspiracy charges when she was in the next room to a cocaine deal and her children, you know, will a judge look at that and say, oh, I'll, you know, that's fine, drug court for you?
They have no authority to do that. They're bound to follow the law, and the judge's hands are tied. What we were also joking during the break is I like to say I'm an old-fashioned girl. I believe in the separation of powers. I think judges should judge. And under the current laws, they are become just rubber stampers of these extraordinary sentences.
Well, and so the power really is in the prosecution's hand.
On what charges are brought, because the charges, if you're convicted, determine by definition what the sentence will be. None of those other factors that you might think about that you were talking about matter. I mean, it's literally the weight of the evidence. I mean, you hear that expression used, but it's literally the weight. How
the
many grams?
Weight.
And we don't measure it in pounds. I mean, it's grams. When we talk about Massachusetts trafficking laws, all of which require mandatory minimum sentences, we're not talking Miami Vice.
Right.
We're not talking about suitcases full of cocaine or speedboats full of marijuana. We're talking about grams, which is the same amount in one packet of Sweet and Low. So our trafficking laws kick in at 18 grams. Which
18
is
grams is 10 grams less than an ounce.
Yes.
To be clear, that's very
it's
light.
It's about 2 tablespoons full. That's for, I should be more clear, that's for class A and B drugs. And some
which
of
are
the,
what?
Heroin, cocaine. Cocaine has mainly been the drug of choice in Massachusetts for decades.
Right.
Prescription drugs. Marijuana is measured in much greater quantities, pounds and tons. But for everything else, it's tiny quantities that yet 2 tablespoons is worth a big chunk of someone's life.
So what can we do? I'm asking this again, but is how do we change this?
Yeah, I've told you how terrible all of this is,
yeah.
So we should talk about how we can fix this problem. We do live in a democracy, and voters have the right to weigh in on these issues. In fact, the only way any change ever comes is if the voters demand it, which is not to say that legislators aren't aware of these issues, but it's going to be driven by the voters. So if somebody would like to see these laws changed, they can certainly sign up for our emails on our website.
What's your website address?
www.famm.org.
Okay.
And we will tell you everything that's going on in terms of the lawmaking process around these bills. We will tell you who needs to be contacted, when, how much time you have, and even give you a sample message. That is the only way we've made change the last 2 legislative sessions. That's the only way it's going to happen going forward.
So I can go on the FAM website, fam.org, and I can look up that stuff. Who funds you guys?
We are all privately funded. We don't get any government money,
and you're,
not surprisingly.
And you're a not-for-profit.
We're nonprofit, nonpartisan. And we actually, both our supporters and our staff are very diverse politically, from the right to the left, because this is an issue that transcends politics, which is why you're seeing, you know, more support now from people who previously didn't support these issues. So all are welcome. We'll sit down with anybody to talk about how to improve the situation, because our goal is to eliminate these sentences.
I mean, it sounds like a win-win situation. You always hear about prison overcrowding.
Right.
Such a large margin, percentage of these people that are in prison are there for nonviolent drug offenses. All around the country, it seems to be an issue. We were talking at the break about the different states having different laws, but overall, this is mandatory minimums have had a great effect on our penal system, on our judicial system. They're clogging up the courts and the prisons for keeping real criminals on the street. I just heard of sentences being deferred because prisons were overcrowded in California. So this seems like a win-win situation if we can change these.
Especially when you think about people, like for your audience members who more may be more interested in the addiction angle, let's deal with the heart of the problem.
Right.
Let's get people healthy, back on their feet. And we all know that can take several tries. You know, nothing's instant. But when you break the cycle, then people can go on with their lives and you don't have that revolving door where we put people into prison. They come out sometimes in worse shape than they went in. And then when they get out, I mean, their options are so limited that you wonder what the end game is there. So at least let's break for those folks that are in prison because of their addiction or substance abuse. Let's get them the help they need so that they don't have to go to prison.
Barb, you're singing my song. I love it. Thank you, Barb Dugan, for taking time out on a Sunday, speaking to Right Turn Radio on this important issue.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you for listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast. Please check us out on Facebook and at www.right-turn.org.